This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 63 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Yeah, it's a great resource.
It really is. All right, so you are here because you need to conquer the Series 63 exam, and today we are going straight into like the belly of the beast, broker-dealer definition and registration.
Oh, it really is the beast.
Yeah, we're taking the source material you need to know and breaking down not just the rules, but the actual mechanics behind them.
Right, and before we get into the legislative weeds, we need to talk about why you, the listener, absolutely must master this specific section.
Definitely.
Because this topic, which is deeply integrated with Unit 4 of your study materials, it makes up a whopping 12% of your entire exam.
12%, that's
It
huge.
is. That translates to 7 questions. And, 7 questions might not sound like a mountain, but on a scaled exam, those 7 questions can absolutely make or break your passing score.
Yeah, that's the difference between walking out of the testing center with your license or having to explain to your manager why you need to retake it in 30 days.
Exactly.
So 12% is massive for one single definition. Let's unpack this right out of the gate. Why is the Uniform Securities Act and, well, by extension, the exam, so obsessively focused on this one specific regulatory definition?
Because it serves as the structural foundation of the entire regulatory framework. You have to think of the Uniform Securities Act as a fortress designed to protect the retail investor.
A fortress.
Right. So before anyone can legally sell a security in a given state, the firm standing behind that transaction must be properly registered. If you cannot correctly identify who the broker-dealer is, the rest of the law is entirely useless.
Wow. Okay. So it's the anchor for everything.
Totally. You can't figure out who the individual agents are, you can't figure out which transactions are exempt, and you certainly can't establish regulatory jurisdiction.
So it's like the absolute starting line of securities law.
Exactly. If you get the definition of broker-dealer wrong, the entire house of cards collapses. The state administrator has just, lost control of the market.
Which brings us to our fundamental agreement for this deep dive. We know you are listening to this because dry academic lectures are the ultimate enemy of focus and retention.
Yeah, nobody learns well that way.
Right. Like reading a textbook that plainly states a broker-dealer is any person engaged in the business of effecting transactions is practically a sedative. It doesn't tell you how the machine actually works.
No, it doesn't at all.
So today we're tossing the textbook reading aside. We are going to explore the underlying logic of these laws. We're going to use vivid, sometimes ridiculous hypotheticals. We're going to use specific character archetypes as memory anchors.
And most importantly, we're going to ask you direct questions to test your memory in real time.
Yes, that is cue.
Because active recall is the only way this level of dense legal information actually sticks in your long-term memory. Passive listening will not get you a passing score.
It really won't.
So when we pause and ask you a direct question, we want you to actively answer it in your head, or, out loud if you're commuting or walking the dog. Just engage with the material.
Exactly. So let's build the foundation. Before we can figure out who has to register with the state, we need to know what a broker-dealer actually does on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
And the hyphen in broker-dealer is incredibly important. Let's introduce our first two archetypes to explain this hyphen. Picture two completely different professionals working on Wall Street. First, we have Broker Bob.
Okay, so let's examine how Broker Bob operates his business. Bob is fundamentally a matchmaker. He's a conduit.
Matchmaker, I like that.
The most critical thing to understand about Bob is that he never, ever risks his own firm's money in the market.
Wait, really? Never.
Never. If you, the client, want to buy 100 shares of a specific tech company, Bob doesn't sell them to you from his own stash.
So where does he get them?
Instead, Bob goes out into the open market, finds a third party who is willing to sell 100 shares, and puts the two of you together. Legally speaking, he is acting in an agency capacity.
Okay. He is your agent acting on your behalf.
Exactly.
I always like to think of this like a traditional real estate broker because the mechanics are
Oh,
identical.
that's a perfect analogy.
Right. Like if I want to buy a house, my real estate broker doesn't buy the house with their own money first and then flip it to me. They just facilitate the transaction between me and the current homeowner.
Spot on.
And because Broker Bob is just the middleman facilitating the trade, he needs to get paid for his matchmaking services. His favorite word starts with a C, commission. Broker Bob earns a commission on the trade.
Yes, so the memory anchor here is a three-part chain. Broker, agency, commission.
Broker, agency, commission. Got it.
That is the perfect baseline. Now, we must contrast Bob with our second archetype, Dealer Dan.
Okay, Dealer Dan. Let's hear it.
Dealer Dan operates under a completely different business model with a totally different risk profile. Dan has a massive inventory of his own securities. He trades for his own account.
Oh, so he's using his own stuff.
Yes. When Dan executes a trade, he is putting his own firm's capital directly at risk. In legal terms, he is acting as a principal.
Okay, to carry my analogy forward, Dealer Dan is operating more like a car dealership.
I see where you're going with this.
If I want to buy a specific sedan, the car dealership doesn't go find someone selling that sedan and introduce us. The dealership used their own corporate capital to buy that sedan last week.
Great. They own it.
Yeah, they parked it on their lot, holding the risk that the value might drop, and now they are selling it directly to me out of their own private inventory.
Precisely. The risk is the defining factor here. Dan took on the market risk of holding that security in his inventory overnight.
Because the market could have crashed.
Exactly, and he would have lost money.
Yeah.
Because he takes on that principal risk, he does not charge a commission.
Oh, interesting. So how does he get paid?
Well, he makes his money by altering the price of the security itself. If Dan is selling a security to you out of his inventory, he charges a markup. He bought it for $10, but he sells it to you for $10.50.
Right, the classic retail markup.
Conversely, if you want to sell a security and Dan buys it from you to put into his inventory, he charges a markdown. He buys your $10 stock for $9.50.
Ah, okay. That makes sense.
So the memory anchor here is dealer, principal, markup or markdown.
So we have Broker Bob acting as an agent for a commission with no market risk, and we have Dealer Dan acting as a principal for a markup or markdown, holding significant market risk.
You got it.
Here's where the mechanics get really interesting, though, and where the exam loves to test your applied knowledge. Most of the major financial institutions you interact with every day, like the massive wirehouses, the trillion-dollar custodians, they are registered as broker-dealers.
Yes. The hyphen is there for a reason.
Right. They have the legal capacity to do both. They absolutely do. As a general corporate entity, they engage in both agency transactions and principal transactions thousands of times a day.
But wait, let's follow the logic here. If a massive firm is legally both a broker and a dealer, what stops them from double dipping on a single retail investor?
Oh, that's the big question.
Like, let's say I place an order. Can the firm act as the principal, sell me a stock directly from their own inventory with a hefty markup, and simultaneously put on their broker hat and charge me an agency commission on that exact same trade?
Never.
Yeah.
And you need to visualize a massive flashing neon sign in your mind when you study this. This is the one hat at a time rule.
One hat at a time. I like that.
A broker dealer operates both business models generally, sure. But they can act in only one capacity on any given individual trade.
So it's either or.
Exactly. They're either wearing the Broker Bob hat or they're wearing the Dealer Dan hat for that specific transaction. They can never wear both hats simultaneously on the same trade.
When you really think about the ethics of it, that makes total sense. If a firm were allowed to do both on a single trade, it would be like an insurmountable conflict of interest.
Well, completely.
They would essentially be negotiating against you to get the best markup for their own inventory, while simultaneously claiming to represent your best interests as your agent and charging you a fee for it.
Right. It's totally contradictory.
You just cannot legally be the seller and the buyer's fiduciary agent at the exact same time without the transaction becoming inherently fraudulent.
And that is the exact regulatory philosophy behind the rule. The Uniform Securities Act was drafted to protect the investor from asymmetrical information and hidden fees.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Preventing that dual capacity double dipping on a single trade is fundamental. It ensures the retail client isn't being quietly bled dry by a firm playing both sides of the fence.
Okay, we established the rules of engagement, and it's time for some active recall.
You're ready.
I'm going to ask you a direct question, and I want you, the listener, to synthesize what we just discussed. Listen carefully and lock in your answer. Pop quiz. If a firm is putting its own capital at risk and trading securities directly from its own account with a retail customer, what specific capacity are they acting in, and how are they compensated for that trade?
Take a second.
Think about their risk profile. They are using their own capital. Lock it in.
Okay. And the answer you should have arrived at is they are acting as a dealer in a principal capacity, and they are earning either a markup or a markdown.
Boom.
Because they are risking their own money, they are playing the role of Dealer Dan.
If you can conceptually separate the agency commission from the principal markup, you have mastered the foundational building block of this entire unit.
It really is the bedrock.
Now let's pivot and look at the borders of this regulatory fortress. We know what a broker-dealer does. We know that if a firm meets this definition, they face a massive, expensive regulatory burden.
Oh yeah, they have to register, pay fees, submit to audits, maintain capital requirements.
But who gets to completely dodge this label? Who gets to walk right past the regulatory bouncer at the door?
To understand who avoids registration, we have to master a heavily tested legal distinction. And that is the difference between an exclusion and an exemption.
This is a big one.
Huge. The examiners love to test whether you understand the nuanced difference between these two specific terms, because legally, they are worlds apart.
But, you know, in everyday conversational English, those words are basically synonyms. If I am excluded from a requirement or I am exempt from a requirement, the end result is the same. I don't have to do it.
Exactly. Which is why it's a trap.
So why does the law care which word we use?
The law cares because it determines jurisdictional power. Let's use your nightclub bouncer analogy.
Okay, I love a good bouncer analogy.
An exclusion means you do not meet the definition of a broker-dealer at all. You're not even in the legal dictionary under that term. You aren't on the bouncer's radar.
So I'm not even trying to get into the club.
Right. You are just a person walking down the public sidewalk past the nightclub. The bouncer standing at the door doesn't ask for your ID. And he doesn't pat you down because you aren't trying to get in.
Ah, okay. The rules of the club simply do not apply to you by definition. You are excluded.
Exactly.
Okay, I follow that. So if an exclusion means I am completely outside the definition and just walking past the club, what exactly is an exemption?
An exemption means you are a broker dealer. You meet the exact statutory definition. You are actively trying to get into the nightclub.
Okay, I'm at the door.
Beauty. You possess a special VIP pass that relieves you from the specific requirement to register in that instance.
Oh, nice.
The bouncer stops you, recognizes that you meet the criteria of a patron, but he sees your VIP wristband and lets you walk in without paying the cover charge.
Got it. So I'm still subject to the club's rules once inside, but I was exempted from the registration fee at the door.
Exactly. You're inside the definition, but relieved of the burden.
And this brings us to a crucial structural detail for you listening. The Uniform Securities Act primarily uses exclusions when it comes to the broker-dealer definition.
That's right.
When we talk about who does not have to register as a BD, it is almost always because the statute explicitly says they are excluded. The law basically says these entities are simply not broker-dealers, period.
That is correct. The Act provides a very specific, not a BD list.
Yeah.
There are four major categories of entities that are completely excluded from the definition of a broker-dealer.
Four categories.
Yep. And if you fall into one of these buckets, the state administrator cannot force you to register as a BD. We need to dissect these one by one. The first category is agents.
Let's think about why that makes logical sense. An agent is the natural person, the human being, who represents a broker-dealer in effecting securities transactions.
Right.
So Broker Bob is an agent. He's a guy in a suit. He works for the firm. He is not the firm itself.
Exactly. The corporate entity is the broker-dealer.
Right. The employee is the agent. You can't call the employee a broker-dealer, so they are naturally excluded from the definition.
Yep. The law separates the corporate entity from the natural person. Second on the statutory exclusion list is issuers.
Okay. Issuers.
If a corporate entity, let's use a giant like Apple as our hypothetical.
Yeah.
If Apple is raising capital by selling its own newly issued stock directly to the public, it is acting in the capacity of an issuer.
Right. It is raising money for its own operations. It is not acting as a broker dealer.
Exactly.
Now let's push the boundaries of that. Apple is excluded while selling its own stock. But what if Apple decided they wanted to set up a trading desk in Cupertino and they started helping their employees buy and sell shares of Microsoft or Tesla or government bonds?
Well, they're facilitating trades of other entities' securities now.
Exactly.
And the moment they step over that line, they lose the issuer exclusion for those activities. By facilitating secondary market trades for other companies' securities, they meet the definition of a broker-dealer and would be required to register as one.
Ah, okay. But as long as they are strictly raising capital by selling their own securities, they remain safely excluded as an issuer.
That distinction is key. Third category on the exclusion list, banks, savings institutions, and trust companies.
Okay, this is where we need to introduce our next set of archetypes, because the banking exclusion is where the examiners set their most devious traps.
Oh, they love testing this.
Let's bring in Banker Betty. Banker Betty runs a traditional old school bank on Main Street. Her institution takes in customer deposits, issues mortgages, offers checking accounts, and, you know, maybe operates a small trust department.
Classic bank.
Exactly. So according to the rule you just laid out, Banker Betty's institution is entirely excluded from the definition of a broker-dealer. The state securities administrator cannot force her bank to register as a BD.
That is absolutely correct. The drafters of the Uniform Securities Act excluded banks primarily because banks are already suffocating under a massive separate layer of federal and state banking regulation.
No, yeah, banking is incredibly regulated.
Right. The securities regulators essentially said, look, the banking regulators already have jurisdiction here. We don't need to pile on. But this brings us to the trap.
The exam loves a good trap. Where do candidates get caught?
They get caught by Banker Betty's highly ambitious cousin.
Oh, no.
We will call him Holding Company Hal. Hal does not run a bank. Hal runs a bank holding company.
A bank holding company. Okay.
A holding company is a separate corporate umbrella entity. Hal's corporation owns Banker Betty's bank, sure, but it might also own an insurance agency, a real estate firm, and a proprietary trading desk.
Okay, let's make sure the corporate structure is crystal clear for you listening. Betty is the CEO of the actual bank on Main Street. Hal is the CEO of the massive parent corporation that owns Betty's bank, plus a bunch of other financial ventures.
Yes. And on the exam, they will present a scenario where holding company Hal engages in securities transactions.
Yeah.
And they will ask if his firm needs to register as a broker-dealer.
Let me guess. Candidates see the word bank in bank holding company, assume the bank exclusion applies, and get the question wrong.
Exactly. Holding company Hal is not excluded.
But why is the law so strict about separating the two?
If we look at the historical context, particularly following the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act and the subsequent financial crises, regulators realized that holding companies take on vastly different, much more complex risks than traditional depository banks.
Right. They aren't just taking deposits.
Exactly. Only the traditional bank entity itself is granted the exclusion. If holding company Hal's umbrella corporation engages in broker-dealer activity, Hal must register his firm as a broker-dealer. The banking exclusion does not travel up the corporate ladder.
Wow, that is a phenomenal memory anchor. Main Street Bank is excluded. Bank holding company is not excluded. Hal has to pay the registration fees.
Exactly.
Now, there is a fourth category of exclusions firms with no place of business in the state, but that rule is so dense and so heavily tested that we're going to dedicate a massive segment to it in just a moment.
We have to. But before we cross state lines into the no place of business maze, we have to address a critical, overarching legal reality about being excluded from the definition.
Oh, hold on. Let me set the stage for this, because this is the biggest catch-all rule in the entire regulatory framework. Let's call it the anti-fraud siren.
I love the visual.
I am bringing this up with maximum intensity, because you cannot afford to misunderstand this. Let's say you are definitively excluded. You are Banker Betty. You are an issuer. You are legally not a broker-dealer, and the state administrator cannot force you to register.
Okay, you're off the radar.
Right. Does that exclusion give you a free pass to run a Ponzi scheme? Does being excluded from registration mean you are immune from the consequences of lying to investors?
Absolutely not. And that is why your metaphorical siren is going off.
Okay, phew.
Being excluded from the broker-dealer definition does not shield anyone, anywhere, from civil or criminal liability for fraud. Let me state this as clearly as humanly possible.
Say it loud.
Everyone who touches the sale of a security is subject to the anti-fraud provisions of the Uniform Securities Act.
You know, I always explain this to people using the concept of gravity.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
You can be legally excluded from paying income taxes. You can be legally excluded from registering your vehicle. But no matter who you are or what legal loopholes you jump through, you cannot be excluded from gravity.
Right, you're subject to it.
If you step off a ledge, you fall. Anti-fraud is the gravity of securities law. If you commit fraud, deceit, or manipulation in connection with the offer or sale of a security, the state administrator has absolute jurisdiction to come after you.
Universal jurisdiction.
It does not matter if you are a bank, an issuer, an agent, or a retail investor. Anti-fraud jurisdiction is universal.
That is a perfect conceptual framing. And the exam tests this exact concept frequently.
How do they usually test it?
They will design a paragraph-long scenario where an explicitly excluded entity, like a traditional bank, intentionally defrauds an elderly investor. Then they will ask, does the state securities administrator have the authority to take action against the bank?
Ah, and candidates who memorize the exclusions might think, well, banks are excluded, so the administrator has no power.
Exactly. But the answer is always yes when fraud is involved. The administrator always has jurisdiction over fraud in their state.
Okay, let's take a quick breath and synthesize. We have covered the two hats. Broker Bob wearing the agency hat for a commission, and Dealer Dan wearing the principal hat for a markup. Never both at once.
Right.
We have covered the VIP bouncer. Exclusions mean you aren't in the definition at all. And we've covered the not a BB list, highlighting the critical difference between Banker Betty being excluded and holding company Hal being on the hook.
Yes.
And looming over all of it is the universal gravity of anti-fraud. Now it is time to step into the maze.
Oh boy. The no place of business exclusion. This is the fourth category of exclusion, and is where candidates face the highest degree of difficulty, so we need to map the boundaries meticulously.
Let's build out the scenario. What if a firm is definitively, unquestionably, a broker-dealer? They aren't a bank, they aren't an issuer, they are a massive Wall Street trading firm, but they are operating across state lines.
Okay.
Let's say Empire Securities is headquartered in a massive skyscraper in New York, but they have clients located down in Florida. Enter the no place of business exclusion.
The absolute non-negotiable prerequisite for this exclusion is exactly what the name implies. The firm must have no office in the state in question.
None at all.
None. If Empire Securities, our New York broker-dealer, decides to open a tiny 100-square-foot broom closet of an office in a strip mall in Florida.
Poof. The exclusion vanishes instantly.
Exactly. The entire exclusion is vaporized the second a physical office is established. If you have any kind of office in the state, you must register as a broker-dealer in that state, period.
Now, what constitutes an office can be kind of fluid in the modern era, right?
Very much so. A rented desk in a co-working space, a dedicated local phone number forwarded to New York, or an agent who regularly meets clients in a specific hotel lobby in Miami can all be construed as an office.
Right.
But assuming there is definitively zero physical footprint, a firm can avoid registration in that foreign state.
Okay, so let's assume Empire Securities operates strictly out of New York and they have absolutely zero physical footprint in Florida. No office, no broom closet, no local PO box.
Got it.
How do they legally conduct securities transactions with people in Florida without registering and paying fees to the Florida administrator?
They have to travel down one of two highly specific regulatory routes. Mm. Let's call them Route A and Route B.
Okay, Route A and Route B.
These are independent paths, so qualifying for either one grants the exclusion. Let's look closely at Route A first, the institution's only path.
Okay, let's unpack. Route A, Empire Securities has no office in Florida. The law states they are excluded from registering in Florida. They affect transactions in Florida exclusively with institutional clients.
And we must rigorously define institutions in this context.
Okay, who counts?
The statute specifically lists other broker-dealers, banks, savings institutions, trust companies, insurance companies, investment companies like massive mutual funds, and pension or profit-sharing trusts.
All right, let's lean into that word exclusively because I feel like that is the linchpin.
It absolutely is.
What if Empire Securities executes 10,000 massive trades in Florida with giant insurance conglomerates and billion-dollar mutual funds, but they also execute just one single trade for a regular retail guy named Dave who lives in Miami?
Route A fails instantaneously.
Instantly, just because of Dave.
Because of Dave. The statutory language is exclusively. It does not say primarily or mostly. Even one single transaction with a non-institutional customer, a retail customer who resides in that state, destroys the exclusively requirement. If Empire Securities executes a trade for Dave, they are no longer doing business exclusively with institutions. They lose the exclusion, and they must immediately register as a broker-dealer in Florida.
Dave just ruined the exemption for a billion-dollar firm.
Thanks, Dave.
So Route A is strictly VIPs only, the biggest institutional players. And here is where I want to wave a massive red flag for anyone listening who is cross-studying. This is a gotcha that consistently catches candidates who overstudy and mix up their rule books.
Oh, I know exactly which trap you're referring to, the $1 million asset rule.
Yes. If you are preparing for the Series 63, you are also studying the rules for investment advisors. And in the investment advisor section of the law, there is a very specific rule that states an employee benefit plan or a pension trust only counts as an institution if it has at least $1 million in total assets.
Right. If it has less than a million, it's treated like a retail client.
But we are not talking about investment advisors right now. We are talking about broker dealers.
and the law views them differently. For broker-dealers operating under Route A, pension and profit-sharing trusts qualify as institutions regardless of their size.
Let me make this as absurd as possible so it really sticks.
Go for it.
Are you telling me that if a pension trust down in Florida has exactly $5 and a rusty paperclip in its portfolio, it still legally counts as an institution for a broker-dealer?
Legally, yes. Do not import the $1 million investment advisor rule into the broker-dealer section. A trust is a trust is a trust when it comes to broker-dealer exclusions.
That is wild.
So if Empire Securities, with no office in Florida, deals exclusively with a tiny $500 pension trust in Florida, they are still excluded from registration. The size of the trust is irrelevant for BDs.
But why? As a learner, if I don't understand the why, I'm going to mix up the rules on test day. Why does an investment advisor have to worry about the $1 million threshold, but a broker-dealer doesn't?
It comes down to the fundamental nature of the business relationship and the regulatory philosophy of risk.
Okay, unpack that.
An investment advisor is providing continuous fiduciary advice. They are literally directing the financial future and survival of that pension trust. If the trust is small, under $1 million, the regulators feel it is highly vulnerable and needs retail-level protection from bad advice.
Oh, I see.
A broker-dealer, however, is essentially just an execution engine. They are taking an order and filling it. They're not acting as fiduciaries guiding the trust's future. They're just facilitating a transaction.
Right.
Because the regulatory risk profile of transaction execution is lower than continuous fiduciary management, the definition of who needs retail protection is different.
That structural logic makes it so much easier to remember. Transactional engines get more leeway on trust size than fiduciary advisors.
Exactly.
Okay, so that covers Route A. No office, strictly institutions, and the size of the trust doesn't matter. But what if Empire Securities does want to do business with a retail client in Florida, but they still vehemently want to avoid registering there? Do they have any other options?
They do, under very specific conditions. Enter Route B, the Snowbird Path.
Ah, it's time to introduce Snowbird Sally.
Let's hear it.
Sally is a retired school teacher. Her permanent legal domicile is in New York. She is an existing, loyal retail customer of Empire Securities in New York.
Let's go.
But it's January, it's freezing in Manhattan, and Sally decides to spend 3 months renting a condo down in Florida to escape the snow. She wants to do some trading while she sits by the pool.
This exact demographic migration is why Route B was written into the law. Let's look at the statutory requirements.
Okay, what are they?
First, the broker-dealer has no office in the state of Florida. Second, the broker-dealer is fully registered and licensed in their home state of New York.
Right, which Empire Securities is.
And third, in Florida, they are offering and selling securities only to a person who is an existing customer whose legal residence is not in Florida.
Let's highlight legal residence, because Sally is just visiting. Her legal domicile, where she pays taxes, where she's registered to vote, is still New York. She is just temporarily residing in Florida. Therefore, Empire Securities does not have to go through the massive logistical nightmare of registering as a BD in Florida just to execute a few trades for their existing New York client while she happens to be on vacation.
Correct. She is an existing client, and her permanent residence is legally elsewhere. Therefore, the broker-dealer qualifies for the exclusion in Florida.
All right, active recall time. I need you to think through the legal boundary of this rule. Direct question to you, the listener.
Listen closely.
What happens if Snowbird Sally decides she absolutely loves the weather? She decides never to return to New York. She permanently moves to Florida, gets a Florida driver's license, registers to vote in Miami, and makes it her primary legal residence.
I can't get beat to think.
Does her New York broker-dealer, Empire Securities, need to register in Florida now if they want to continue executing trades for her? Think about the definition of Route B, her legal residence. Lock in your answer.
And the logical conclusion is yes, because her permanent legal residence is now located in the no-office state.
Yeah.
The moment Sally legally becomes a permanent resident of Florida, Route B instantly fails. Remember, Route B only provides an exclusion if the existing customer's residence is not in the state where the BD has no office.
So the legal trigger is the change of domicile. If Empire Securities wants to keep Sally as a client now that she's officially a Floridian, they have to bite the bullet, file the paperwork, and register in Florida.
Precisely. And this hard line brings us to the ultimate trap set by the examiners, what we call the de minimis myth.
Oh, this one is absolutely brutal. I have seen countless candidates fail practice exams because they cross-contaminate their knowledge here.
It is arguably the most common trick on the exam. Let me be unequivocally clear, and I want you to burn this into your memory. There is no de minimis exemption for broker-dealers.
None. Zero.
Let's break down exactly what de minimis means so we understand the trap. The phrase is Latin for about minimal things.
Right. In the investment advisor rulebook, again, we have to compare the two because the exam loves to exploit the differences. An investment advisor with no office in a state is allowed to have up to 5 retail clients in that state without having to register.
Yes, the 5 client buffer.
The state essentially says, look, 5 clients is such a minimal footprint, we won't bother making you register. It's a numerical buffer.
But for broker dealers, that numerical grace period simply does not exist. If a broker dealer has no office in a state, but they take on even 1 retail client who legally resides in that state, they must register immediately.
One, just a single client. If Dave from Miami, a permanent Florida resident, signs up for a retail account with Empire Securities, Empire must register in Florida.
Immediately.
There is no up to 5 clients buffer. 1 resident retail client equals mandatory registration.
And this naturally raises the question, why? Why do investment advisors get a 5 client buffer while broker dealers get absolutely zero leeway?
Yeah, it feels unfair.
Again, it traces back to the systemic nature of the business. Broker dealers are high velocity transaction engines. A single retail client at a broker dealer might execute thousands of high frequency trades in a single month, moving millions of dollars in and out of the state's economy.
Oh, that makes sense.
The volume, velocity, and systemic risk of money moving through a broker dealer are vastly different than an investment advisor who might just be passively managing a portfolio and meeting with a client twice a year.
Wow, okay.
State securities regulators demand absolute immediate oversight over BDs the millisecond they touch a single permanent resident.
So let's tightly summarize the no place of business maze before we shift our focus. If you have any physical office in the state, you must register. End of story.
Yep.
If you have no office, you can avoid registration by either dealing exclusively with institutions under Route A. And remember, Dave, the retail guy, ruins this instantly. And the size of a pension trust is irrelevant. Or R, you can avoid registration under Route B by only dealing with existing clients who are temporarily visiting, like Snowbird Sally. But the absolute moment Sally changes her legal domicile to that state, or the moment you take on Dave as a new resident client, you are registering because there is no de minimis buffer for BDs.
That is a flawless synthesis.
Yeah.
If you understand the mechanics of those boundaries, you will confidently navigate any no place of business scenario they throw at you on the exam.
Okay, let's zoom out and look at the macro picture. We've been spending all our time talking about state registration, the jurisdiction of Florida, New York, the state administrator.
Right.
But what about the absolute top of the food chain? What about the federal government and the SEC? If a broker dealer is a massive multi-billion dollar behemoth and they register at the federal level with the SEC, they can just flash their federal SEC badge and ignore the states, right?
You're describing the myth of federal supremacy in registration, and it is entirely fundamentally false.
Wait, really? So federal registration isn't an all-access, nationwide VIP pass?
Not for broker dealers. The regulatory system operates under concurrent jurisdiction. Federal registration with the SEC under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 does not satisfy, preempt, or serve as a substitute for state registration.
Oh, wow.
If a broker-dealer is registered federally with the SEC, they must also register in each and every individual state where they conduct non-exempt business with retail residents.
I want to use an analogy here to make this dual registration burden make sense. Think of the entire U.S. regulatory system as a giant apartment building.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
The federal government, the SEC, is the landlord who owns the whole building. The state administrator is the tenant who's renting a specific apartment inside that building.
I like the architecture of this analogy. Let's build it out.
The landlord, the SEC, sets the overarching structural rules for the entire building. They lay the foundation. No tearing down load-bearing walls. The plumbing must be up to federal code.
Right, the big structural stuff.
The tenant, however, the state administrator, has absolute authority over who is allowed to step across the threshold into their specific apartment.
Okay, yeah.
The landlord can't just approve a guest in the lobby and say, I cleared this guy, he can walk into anyone's apartment whenever he wants. the guest still has to knock on the tenant's door, and the tenant still has to give permission for that person to enter their specific sovereign space.
That is a highly accurate representation of how state registration functions alongside federal registration.
Awesome.
The SEC says you are a legally recognized capitalized broker-dealer at the national level. But the state administrator in Florida says, that's wonderful, but if you want to walk into my state and solicit my residence, you have to register with me, file my paperwork, and pay my state filing fees.
But wait, if the state administrator, the tenant, has all that sovereign power to demand registration, can they just make up crazy draconian rules that contradict the SEC's foundational rules? Can the tenant tell the landlord how to engineer the building's foundation?
No, they cannot. And this is where the SEC does strictly cap state power to prevent regulatory chaos.
Okay, good.
Returning to your analogy, the tenant can decorate the interior of the room however they want, but they cannot alter the structural, load-bearing rules the landlord established. Federal law dictates that a state cannot exceed or supersede the SEC's standards in several very specific, highly testable operational areas.
Okay, let's list those areas out clearly. Where exactly does the SEC draw the line and say to the states, back off, our federal standard is the absolute ceiling?
There is a specific list of operational mechanics you need to recognize. A state administrator cannot mandate requirements that exceed the SEC standards for minimum net capital.
Okay, let's translate that. Meaning, if the SEC dictates that a firm needs $100,000 in reserve capital to legally operate, a rogue state administrator cannot suddenly demand they hold $500,000 just to do business in their state.
Correct. The state must accept the federal capital requirement as sufficient. Furthermore, a state cannot exceed SEC standards for custody rules, margin requirements, financial responsibility, bonding requirements, record keeping, or financial and operational reporting formats.
Wow, that's a lot of operational stuff. Let's explore the why behind that, because memorizing a list is hard, but understanding the logic is easy. Why did the federal government aggressively preempt the states on those specific operational things like record keeping, capital, and margin?
You have to imagine the operational apocalypse that would occur if they didn't cap it.
Operational apocalypse.
Imagine a national broker-dealer trying to operate in all 50 states. If every single state administrator had the power to mandate a different requirement for how long you had to retain server emails, or what specific mathematical formula you had to use for margin accounts, or what proprietary format your quarterly financial reports had to be submitted in.
Oh my God, the paperwork.
The firm would need 50 separate compliance departments. The regulatory friction would be so high, it would be functionally impossible to run a national brokerage firm.
It would bring the entire U.S. financial system to a grinding halt under the weight of contradictory paperwork.
Exactly.
So the federal government steps in and says, look, we are setting the absolute ceiling for the structural operational mechanics. States, you cannot ask for more capital or longer record retention than we do. We need uniformity.
Right.
But states, you still absolutely retain the sovereign power to demand that these firms register with you and pay your state fees before they do business with your resident.
Precisely. The federal government ensures uniform operational standards so interstate commerce can function smoothly, while the states retain their right to act as the ultimate gatekeeper protecting their own citizens.
So, synthesizing this for the exam, SEC registration does not replace state registration. You have to jump through both hoops, but the state cannot force you to keep records longer or hold more capital than the SEC requires. The landlord controls the structure, the tenant controls the doorway.
Excellent. Now that we have thoroughly covered the complexities of crossing domestic state lines, what happens when a firm wants to cross international borders?
Ooh, grab your passports, because we are heading north. We are diving into the Canadian invasion, or, you know, in regulatory terms, Canadian limited registration.
Yes, the Uniform Securities Act provides a very specific, streamlined, limited registration process exclusively for Canadian broker-dealers. Not Mexico, not the United Kingdom, not Japan, just Canada.
Why just Canada? Why do they get a special VIP lane in the U.S. regulatory system?
Because of the deeply intertwined nature of our economies, our massive shared physical border, and frankly, the sheer volume of cross-border snowbirds and expats.
That makes sense.
The state regulators eventually realized that forcing every Canadian broker who just wanted to serve as a vacationing client to go through the massive, full-blown U.S. registration process was economically inefficient and ultimately harmed the investors who just wanted access to their home country accounts.
Okay, so let's introduce our final archetype, Canadian Carl.
Welcome, Carl.
Carl runs a highly successful broker-dealer headquartered in Toronto. He is fully registered and in good standing in the province of Ontario. He is a member of a Canadian self-regulatory organization. And importantly, he has absolutely no physical office in any U.S. state.
Key detail.
But he wants to legally do a little bit of business with clients who are physically in the U.S. What does Carl actually have to do to get this limited registration?
Well, instead of hiring a team of U.S. lawyers to navigate the full federal and state registration gauntlet, Carl can file for a limited registration.
Nice and easy.
The process is streamlined. He files his standard Canadian home province application forms. The U.S. states coordinate to accept these rather than forcing him to translate his business into U.S. forms. And he files a crucial document called a consent to service of process.
Consent to service of process. What is that?
This document basically states, if I break U.S. law, you have the legal right to sue me in a U.S. court and I cannot hide behind the Canadian border.
Okay, so Carl files the streamlined paperwork. He pays his fees. He gets his limited registration approved. Does that mean he can just set up a marketing booth in Times Square and start aggressively opening brokerage accounts for ordinary New Yorkers?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
His limited registration severely restricts exactly who he is legally allowed to talk to.
Mm.
He's limited to two very specific, strictly defined, and independent categories of clients.
Let's break these two categories down meticulously because the exam absolutely loves to mix up the rules for Category 1 and Category 2 to see if you're paying attention.
Category 1 is what we will call the Canadian snowbird. This is a person from Canada who is temporarily resident in the U.S. state.
Like, they are visiting Florida for the winter, just like Snowbird Sally, but they are traveling down from Toronto instead of New York.
Exactly. But there is a massive, heavily tested rule attached to this category.
Let's hear it.
Canadian Carl must have had a bona fide pre-existing broker-dealer client relationship with this person before they entered the United States.
Wait, really? Let's trace the logic on that. So if a Canadian guy comes down to Florida for the winter and he happens to meet Canadian Carl at a golf course in Miami, Carl cannot open a brand new account for him right then and there, even though they are both Canadian.
No, he cannot. Carl can only service him under the limited registration if they already had an established business relationship back in Canada before the client crossed the border.
Wow. Okay.
That is the essence of Category 1. The client must be a temporary resident and there must be a prior relationship.
Got it.
The U.S. regulators designed it this way, so Canadian firms couldn't use the limited registration as a loophole to aggressively hunt for new clients on U.S. soil, even if those targets are Canadian citizens.
That makes perfect sense. They want to allow continuity of service, not open a new hunting ground. Okay, so what is Category 2?
Category 2 is the retirement plan holder. This is a person from Canada who actually permanently resides in the U.S. state.
Meaning they have fully moved here. They are domiciled in the U.S. now.
Yes, they are permanent residents. However, Carl can only execute transactions for them within a self-directed, tax-advantaged Canadian retirement plan. Think of systems like a Canadian RRSP, a registered retirement savings plan. It functions similarly to a U.S. IRA.
Okay, so if this permanent resident wants to buy regular stocks in a standard taxable brokerage account, Carl cannot help them. Carl can only legally manage the specific Canadian retirement account that the client brought with them when they moved across the border.
Correct. And here is the absolute crucial distinction that you must memorize. For Category 2, there is no prior relationship required.
Whoa. Let's flag that and hold on it for a second. So if a Canadian citizen permanently moves to Texas and they have a complex Canadian retirement plan that needs managing, they can call up Canadian Carl, whom they have never met before in their life, and Carl can legally manage that specific retirement plan for them.
Yes, under the limited registration, that is perfectly legal.
But why the discrepancy? Why does the snowbird need a prior relationship, but the permanent resident with a retirement plan doesn't?
It comes down to economic reality and tax treaties.
Okay, explain that.
If a Canadian moves to the U.S. and is forced to liquidate their Canadian tax-advantaged retirement plan just because their old broker isn't licensed in the U.S., they would face catastrophic tax penalties.
Oh, that would be awful.
The regulators realize that finding a broker who understands cross-border retirement tax law is incredibly difficult. If they restricted it so the client could only use a broker they already had a prior relationship with, they might trap the investor.
That makes a lot of sense.
So, to protect the investor's retirement savings, they drop the prior relationship requirement for this highly specific type of account.
That is fascinating. The regulators actually created a loophole out of financial mercy.
Yeah.
Okay, it is active recall time. I need you, the listener, to mentally sort these two categories because the examiners will try to blend them together.
Be ready.
I will prompt you. You answer in your head. Category one, a temporary resident like a snowbird.
Right.
Do they need a prior relationship with the broker?
Take a second.
Yes, they absolutely do. Okay, category two, a permanent resident seeking management of a Canadian tax-advantaged retirement plan. Do they need a prior relationship?
Think about it.
No, they do not.
The exam will absolutely try to trick you by offering a scenario where a Canadian firm manages a retirement plan for a new permanent resident, and one of the multiple choice answers will falsely claim it's illegal because there was no prior relationship.
That is sneaky.
They mix and match the rules. Keep them strictly in their separate conceptual buckets.
That is one of the most common and devastating gotchas on the exam. Now, there is another massive gotcha associated with Canadian Carl, and it involves a highly unusual date.
Oh, yes.
If you are taking notes, grab a highlighter, circle this, and put stars around it. If you remember one single date from this entire deep dive, make it this one.
Canadian limited registrations must be renewed before December 1st of each year.
December 1st, not December 31st. Not the end of the calendar year, like literally everything else in the financial and tax world.
Oh.
December 1st. Why on earth would the regulators pick December 1st?
It is purely a matter of bureaucratic logistics.
Bureaucratic logistics.
Yeah. At the end of the year, state administrators are utterly overwhelmed with the renewal paperwork for hundreds of thousands of domestic U.S. broker-dealers and investment advisors.
Oh, right. The rush.
By forcing the Canadian limited registrations to renew a month early, on December 1st, it gives the state administrators a 30-day buffer to process all the complex international paperwork and clear it off their desks before the massive domestic avalanche hits on December 31st.
It's just a clerical traffic control mechanism. But because it is the one date that breaks the normal pattern, the examiners love to test it. December 1st.
Mark it down.
Okay, so Carl is registered. He renewed his paperwork on December 1st. He's legally managing his temporary snowbirds and his permanent residence retirement plans. What else is he allowed to do within the borders of the U.S.?
He can do institutional business, just like any other out-of-state BD would under Route A.
Hmm.
He can trade with massive banks, insurance companies, and other broker-dealers.
Oh, nice.
But what he absolutely cannot do under any circumstances is solicit ordinary new retail U.S. clients. He cannot run advertisements on U.S. television or send mailers trying to get Americans to open standard brokerage accounts with his firm.
Because he only holds a limited registration, if he wants access to the lucrative American retail market, he has to pay the toll and go through the full U.S. registration gauntlet like everyone else.
Exactly. And because he is operating under this special limited registration, he is actually legally exempt from the vast majority of the Uniform Securities Act's standard rules.
Wait, really? He gets to operate in the U.S. but doesn't have to follow the U.S. rules?
Mostly, yes.
Yeah.
The U.S. regulators rely on the fact that he is highly regulated back in Canada, so they allow him to follow his home country's operational rules for things like record keeping.
That's a huge perk.
But there is one fundamental U.S. rule he is never, ever exempt from. Care to guess what it is?
Oh, the anti-fraud siren.
You got it. The universal gravity of anti-fraud. Even Canadian Carl, operating under a limited registration, is fully subject to U.S. anti-fraud provisions.
Right.
If he commits fraud, deceit, or manipulation while dealing with a client in a U.S. state, the state administrator has the absolute authority to revoke his limited registration immediately and pursue legal action.
But wait, if he's exempt from most of the standard U.S. operational rules, do his clients actually know that? Does the Canadian snowbird sitting in Florida realize that Carl isn't subject to the full weight and scrutiny of the U.S. regulatory system?
They do, because Carl is legally compelled to tell them. That is a strict ongoing duty of his limited registration.
Okay, good.
He must explicitly disclose to his clients located in the state that he and his agents are not subject to the full regulatory requirements of the U.S. Uniform Securities Act.
So he essentially has to say, hey guys, I am Canadian Carl. I am legally managing your trades here in Florida. But just as a disclaimer, I am playing by Canadian operational rules, not the full U.S. rulebook. He is legally required to make that disclosure.
He is. And furthermore, if he gets into any regulatory trouble back home, if he faces any criminal action or a regulatory sanction involving fraud, theft, or dishonest practices in Canada, he must promptly and formally inform the U.S. State Administrator.
Which makes total sense. The U.S. regulators are letting him operate based on the honor system of his home country's regulations. So if he loses his good standing and his honor back in Canada, the U.S. states need to know immediately so they can evaluate if he is still fit to hold his limited registration.
That thoroughly covers the mechanics of the Canadian limited registration. It is a highly specific niche topic, but because of its complexity, it consistently produces one or two very tricky questions on the exam.
All right, my brain is officially reaching full capacity. We have covered a massive amount of dense, highly testable material. Let's lock this in your memory right now before exam day.
Let's do it.
We promised a rapid-fire recap of the absolute top testable takeaways, so let's hit them hard and fast.
Takeaway number one, the hats. A broker acts in an agency capacity, taking no market risk, and earns a commission. A dealer acts in a principal capacity, risking their own capital through inventory, and earns a markup or markdown. A firm can be legally registered as both, but they can never act as both on a single specific trade. One hat at a time to prevent conflicts of interest.
Takeaway number two, the exclusions. Agents, issuers, and banks are excluded from the definition of a broker-dealer entirely. But remember our archetypes. Banker Betty's traditional bank is safe and excluded, but holding company Howell's massive parent corporation is not excluded. Bank holding companies must register. And remember the gravity of the law. No matter who you are, no matter what exclusion you hold, the anti-fraud provisions always apply to you.
Takeaway number three, the no place of business maze. If you have absolutely no office in a state, you can avoid registration through Route A by dealing exclusively with institutions. And crucially, remember that the size of a pension trust does not matter for broker-dealers. Do not fall for the $1 million investment advisor trap.
Takeaway number four, the snowbird and the de minimis myth. Route B lets you deal with existing retail clients who are just temporarily visiting the state. But the exact second they become a permanent resident or the second you take on a new resident retail client, you must register. Because there is no de minimis exemption for broker-dealers. One single resident retail client means you are legally required to register.
Takeaway number five, federal supremacy and the Canadian provision. SEC registration never replaces or preempts state registration. You must register with both the landlord and the tenant. However, the SEC strictly caps state power over operational rules like capital and record keeping. And for Canadian Carl, limited registration always renews on December 1st. He can serve as temporary residence only if he had a prior relationship, and he can serve as permanent residence tax-advantaged retirement plans with no prior relationship required.
Wow. That is 12% of your exam, completely decoded, stripped of the legal jargon, and delivered. But before we let you get back to your flashcards and practice quizzes, our expert has a final provocative thought for you to chew on, something that bridges the rigid historical textbook rules we just learned with the incredibly complex reality of the financial world we actually live in today.
I want you to think critically about how the modern digital age impacts that no place of business rule we spent so much time dissecting. We talked about physical footprints, broom closets, and rented desks. But we live in an era where a multi-billion dollar trading firm might exist entirely as an app on your smartphone, operating on decentralized cloud servers scattered across the globe, utilizing algorithmic trading that crosses state lines in microseconds.
That's a great point.
When a firm has no physical headquarters and lives entirely in the cloud, where are they really located? As technology and borderless digital assets rapidly outpace these traditional physical definitions written decades ago, state regulators are constantly scrambling to figure out how to pin down and assert jurisdiction over an entity that technically has no geography.
It's totally unprecedented.
Keep that tension in mind as you study the rest of these laws. The rules you are memorizing are rigid and based on physical borders, but the real world they are trying to regulate is becoming increasingly fluid and borderless.
That is a phenomenal perspective to hold on to as you navigate this material. Understanding the friction between the old laws and the new reality will make you a much sharper financial professional. Keep pushing forward, keep utilizing that active recall, and good luck crushing this section of your exam. You've got this.